A lot of academic books on the Silk Road, but actually for novels, very, very few. I Googled a little this morning. Actually, I found a children's book on the Silk Road, but novel maybe one or two. Anyway, and also I want to say this week has been very hectic for me because yesterday I just sent in my whole manuscript by 380 pages to the editor for my next novel. Thank you. Thank you. It's called The Skeleton Woman. As you know, writing a novel is very, very hard work. And I just sent it yesterday, so I feel much lighter today and happier. And some of my friends said, oh, Skeleton Woman, is it about anorexic? No, nothing about that. Actually, this is about, that will be my next novel, Femme Fatale, you know, like in French. Because, like those women, they can turn you into skeletons. Not they are skeletons themselves. Okay, I'll talk a little bit, because I don't want to bore you, about the Silk Road. The Silk Road, as the name implies, of course, is about silk, right? Because Chinese merchants, they trade silk with the West. But actually, the Silk Road is not just one route, I'm sure, you know, most of you know. It's actually various interconnected routes, you know, and they connect the capital of Chang'an in the Tang Dynasty, you know, about 1,000 years ago. And now we call it Xi'an. I'm sure you know about that. So connect this capital all the way to Central Asia. And there are different routes, many, many routes, not just one. And they connect, they pass through cities which are now former, some of the former Soviet Union, Pakistan, Persia, and as far as Rome. So when we talk about nowadays, we talk about a lot East meets West, right? The cultural exchange. But actually 1,000 years ago, you know, China had been actively doing this for a long time. So what kind of people travel on the Silk Road? I mean, this is very dangerous, of course. I mean, it's not an easy path. Merchants, of course. Chinese merchants go to the West and they sell the goods there and they trade, you know, the Western goods back. Armies, you know, soldiers, you know, fighting wars. Diplomatic envoy, you know, sent by the emperor, try to kind of negotiate peace like ambassador nowadays. And also, of course, pilgrims, right? I mean, religious people. And the last, adventurers, explorers. And that's what my novel is about, a woman adventurer. Okay, so what kind of goods that the Chinese people bring to the West to sell? First, most important, is silk, of course. And I remember more than 10 years ago in the Cleveland Museum in Cleveland, they have the best collection of Chinese art, even better than the one here. But you can't see it because it's all in story, show more of the work. And why they have much better Chinese art in Cleveland rather than here is because of people, always, because of the curator, because he was very, very knowledgeable about Chinese art, you know, 50 years ago, and then he bought it dirt cheap, right? That era now, of course, it's worth millions and millions. Anyway, so they have an exhibition that's called Silk is Gold. And you know what that means? That means silk is so much in demand by the rich and powerful in the West after they know that Chinese had silk, something called, and it will pay everything. So you can actually trade silk for gold. That's why it's called Silk is Gold, that exhibition. Okay, Chinese also bring tea leaves to the West, lacquer, bronze mirrors, you know, very famous Chinese bronze mirrors, bamboo wares, and also one important thing, Chinese medicine, right? We all believe in Chinese medicine. Okay, so in my novel, I also have a healer in the novel, a Chinese healer, herbalist. And he's going to get a very precious herb for the protagonist. And this herb is on the Silk Road in the place called Tian Shan, the Heavenly Mountain. Very, very high up, of course. And this special herb is called the Tian Shan Xue Lian, Heavenly Mountain Snow Lotus. Very, very precious herb. It's so precious. And it's so expensive because they grow in the, on cliffs and with ice. So it's very, very hard to gather, to collect those herbs. That's then what happened. There are a lot of fakes. people even fake, you know, this. So what did the Chinese bring back from the West? A lot of animals, lions, elephants, camels, and there is something called the heavenly, especially bred horses, and it's called Tianma, heavenly horses in that era. And they also brought back a lot of spices and perfumes and glassware. Okay, so Silk Road is extremely dangerous. What kind of danger? Natural disasters, of course. It's very, very hot because of the desert there. And there is one desert also, I wrote it in my novel, it's called the Taklamakan Desert. And Taklamakan Desert means go in but never come out. You see how dangerous it is. However, when I did my research, I found out actually that was a Western woman. I forget her nationality. She did cross in very, very horrible, you know, situation by herself, crossed the desert, and she survived. And that is really something. And of course, we have the Gobi Desert. Okay, so, and besides natural disasters, of course, it's bandits. A lot of bandits just kill you and then get all the goods, because all these goods, you know, in transaction. And so there is a famous saying that you don't need to, there is no need for signpost, you know, on a Silk Road, because you just follow the skeletons, because people just die on the route out of dehydration or heat, stroke, all kinds of things. You just follow and then you can go, you know, where you want to go. All right, so I think I'll move on to tell a little bit about my travel on the Silk Road, and then I'll tell about my boat, and I'll do Silk Road calligraphy. Oh, already here. My husband, this is my husband, and we went there in 2004. We wanted to go to Silk Road for a long, long time because it really fascinated us because of all the treasures, frescoes, all the, you know, stories that you heard. But then we don't want to go with just a tourist group, commercial ones, because they just rush. You really can't see anything at all. You know, just take a picture, show that you've been there. You know, those kind of tours. So finally we enrolled in, we just happened to know that the Getty Museum, they had a conference tour in Dunhuang, you know, Dunhuang. So we applied, but first time we were turned down because it's very, very hard to get in because it's just for academics who study the Dunhuang treasures, not for anyone else. Even I'm academic, but I'm not my area. So we were turned down. So we just keep working on it. So finally, maybe they were so moved by our insistence. Finally, they took us. So we went to the tour with whole group of scholars. And also, I don't know whether it's the right word in English, conservationist. Do you have this word? They conserve. Conservationist. Yeah, conservationist. Yeah, they repair all those frescoes, you know, statues, all those things. So a group of these experts, and then another group is all scholars, academic scholars. So we were able to join them. Okay, so you can see the... Did you see the... Oops. Oh, okay. Oh. There's no light. You can see the title. Did you see? Oh, yeah. You have to point at it. Did you see this?
Yeah.
Okay. Conference on the conservation of grotesque sites. Yeah, that's the conference that we went to. And, of course, then we had a tour of the, different parts of the Silk Road. Not all, it's not possible. Okay, let me see the next one. Okay, so these are two of the scholars. And this is the whole place. You can see the grotto. You can go inside and see all the treasures, you know, frescoes, statues. And you see this actually... all sand, like in the desert, you know. This is another facet of that place. Okay, so when you go inside this grotto, first you have to go through a corridor, but a very small one, before you go inside the big space that you see all the frescoes and statues. Why? Because this is the corridor. The reason is because to prevent the sun from shining and damage all the really, really treasure inside. But they don't waste the corridor, so they still did paintings, you know, and everything on the corridor. And many, many of these were damaged, which is very, very sad. As you know, Chinese, you know, arts damaged for 5,000 years. Okay, this is inside the grotto. And I didn't take a picture. The Chinese, I'm sure you all heard, a very famous painter, I mean, like Picasso, as famous as Picasso of the West. Actually, he was named Picasso of the West. Zhang Daqian, right? Everybody knows in China. And this painter, actually, he damaged a lot, destroyed a lot of the frescoes. And he also copied a lot. You know, because even if you copy those frescoes, because besides it's so precious as, you know, national treasures, also because they all have some very, spiritual power. You copy it, you just have the, you receive the good karma. this is another one you can see that is damaged. You can't really see very clearly. Of course, you can see the Buddha there. I mean, it's mostly Buddhist, you know, Buddhist textures. And this one is about an orchestra, because my academic field, I'm an ethnomusicologist. I mean, I play this instrument. That's why I took this picture. And this is portray the orchestra in the Western paradise. It's a Buddhist theme. Okay, so you see this kind, you have to climb this kind of thing to see. I don't know where I took this picture, I don't remember anymore, but you have to climb something like this. And the interesting thing is, I remember, I don't know whether it's exactly this one. It's very, very high up, but we have stairs now, of course. There are stairs, they built the stairs, so we just walk up. But it's still scary, even the stairs, because it's very narrow and you fall down. And one cave is when you walk up, when you fall, if accidentally you fall, you have nothing at your back. You fall down the cliff. So it's very, very dangerous. So I remember the scholar took us up to one of these, something like this, top one. Why? Because there was a cave there that nobody, you know, knows. I mean, nobody knew in the past. There was a cave with, you know, Buddha's frescoes. But the thing is, the very interesting question, and he told us this, because we all walk up the stairs, but remember 1,000 years ago, they told us there were no stairs. So how did the monk go up there? And you know, because of the religious persecution, because a lot of them, they hid their treasures, you know, high up inside the cave and hid themselves too. So how did they go up there? Really no staircase. Not at all. And now, of course, I mean, there are, but in the past, no. So my only conclusion is, if you have ever read Chinese martial arts novel, 武侠小说, we have this qinggong, the floating martial arts, maybe all those Shaolin monks, they can walk on the wall, and maybe that's how they went up there. And that was portrayed in my novel too. I mean, some of the monks knew that kind of kung fu. And actually, I did see monks doing that in Shaolin temple. They can walk on the wall. But of course, I mean, only like 2 seconds. I mean, not a lot, but they can walk like 2 seconds. So that's the only explanation that they can... Okay. So one of the caves like this. And of course, this is newly built. And that's my husband meditating. Like, you know the story of Daruma, the Zen, supposed to be the founder of Zen, Dalai Lama, you know. Okay. He's supposed to facing the wall for 9 years, right, in meditation. So my husband was imitating him facing the wall. And then finally he, not my husband, but that Rama, he was so tired, he tear off his eyelid because he meditated, you know, for 9 years. And then he flew it down on the ground, and then it became tea leaves in China. That's the legend, of course. Only a legend. Okay, that's me saying hello. Ah, okay, this is interesting. We went to the Tefan Museum, and they had a collection of corpses, mummies, which I would say is pretty disgusting when you actually see it. But because such a rare chance that we have a chance to see a 5,000-year mummy, of course, We went inside to see. There are three or four. And you're not supposed to take pictures, strictly forbidden. But I did sneak in to take one because, you know, security was pretty lax in China still. So I took one, but I'm not going to show you today because some of you might be disturbed. But you see the mummy? And the most famous mummy is called the Lou Lan mummy. Anyone of you heard of it? Lou Lan. Okay, that is on the Silk Road. This is the most ancient mummy, 3,000 years old. And archaeologists, judging from her bones, you know, bone structure of her face, reconstructed her whole face, and she became a beautiful Eurasian lady, really beautiful. And then that's why she was called the Lou Lan beauty. So when we saw that, and I asked my husband, do you think she's beautiful? And my husband's answer was, assuming she's 3,000 years old, she's not too bad looking. She preserved herself well. And so the famous Lou Lan. Okay, so we went to Xinjiang as a Muslim, you know. And that's they're doing the morning prayer, and they all wear the hats, as you all know. And this is the marketplace, and I assume these are lamb, right? I mean, because they can't eat beef. They can't so that has to be, everything is lamb everywhere. I mean, in Xinjiang. And there's just some street musician. Okay, I was taking picture with as a very kind of a poor village, and I went there to visit them and just took pictures with them and the little marketplace. Okay, this is interesting. This lady here, and they told me that she's the oldest woman in the whole village. She's about like 120, 110, something like this. So of course I want to stand next to her to get her longevity, to share some of her longevity. But actually, is she really 120? Nobody knows. I mean, this village, right? I mean, no documents actually. But she looks pretty old, that's it. There's nothing. Okay, there's the little kids, you know, perform and ask for money. This is the Heavenly Lake, Tianhu is it called? It's from Heavenly Mountain. You can see, you know, the lake is really very, very refreshing, the air and everything. Oh, this is I just mentioned the medicine, the Tianshan Xuelian, the snow lotus of the Heavenly Mountain. And that's where they grow, you can see. It's very, very difficult to find. So it's very, very expensive, but it's supposed to cure a lot of disease. And I wrote that in my novel. Okay, camel riding. Ah, this one. The Chinese. My Chinese friends should know. Yang Guan. Okay. I played a musical instrument called the qin, you know, gu qin, seven-string zither. And there's a very famous piece called the Three Variations of the Yang Guan Pass, Yang Guan San Die. Okay. So what happened to this place? And this is just the remnants, of course. In ancient time, was a lot more than this. You pad this gate, what do you call it? A path. Then you left China and to go to the wilderness or whatever. So you might be exiled or you might explore something. You just, you know. But a very sad thing, you know, the song that I play actually has lyrics. If the lyrics is, you know, after we drank this cup of wine, we will never see each other again after you go beyond the past. Because, you know, remember 1,000 years ago, you leave that, you never come back. And some women, they left in order to marry what we call a barbarian. Barbarian, because those outside Han China, Chinese in that era all called them barbarian. So they marry those barbarian and they never come back. Very sad story, very, very sad. Because they marry for what reason? Political. Because then China want to have political like ally with the barbarians, so-called. And then they marry the beautiful girls there, so they become the princess or the queen. But those girls, they never saw the family again. That's for life. It's very sad stories. So many, many of those stories. So this is the past. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, so in Dunhuang is where all those treasures, those grottos, I just happened to see an instrument store. It's not that unusual. However, because I saw my instrument, the qin, that is very unusual because it's just very unheard of, that instrument that I play, because it's the most ancient Chinese instrument. So I went in to talk, to check with the owner, and this is the owner, and I played his instrument. And then I went to a temple, a Taoist temple, and it just happened that I saw this young Taoist monk, very young, like 22, 23, I guess, and I saw him carrying my instrument. I ran after him, I grabbed him, I said, oh wow, how come someone plays an instrument here in this remote part of China? And then he told me that he really liked the instrument, but he didn't have a teacher, because no teacher, too remote. So he self-taught himself to play this instrument. I said, oh, I played this instrument for maybe 25 years then, now it's 30, I guess. And I said, I'll teach you. So I gave him three lessons, one piece called Three Variations of the Plum Blossom. I think that's the end. Okay, where's Anthony? Anthony, I need the trailer now because I'm going to talk about my book now, and then you can ask questions and you can buy my book, of course. I can sign for you, and then I'll do calligraphy. So you know the story, right? You remember? Actually, I wrote the novel, Song of the Silk Road. It's not because I was inspired after my trip to the Silk Road. Actually, it's by something else. There is a very famous Chinese author. The Chinese, I think, you know about her. Sun Mao. Yeah, very, very famous, right? I mean, Sun Mao from Taiwan. Yeah, not China. And I really, really like her reading. I just can read her works over and over and over again. I mean, I rarely do that for any other writers, only her. And her writing is very simple. Actually, it's not literally a flowery or, you know, anything discussion about philosophy of life, that kind of thing. But somehow I can tell she's the one really speaks from her heart, and also all those adventures. And she lived with her husband because she was obsessed by Africa. The desert, Sahara Desert. She moved with her husband to live in the Sahara Desert for I don't know how many years. However, and then she wrote a lot of so-called travelogue, is it, essays, you know, about her life in Africa, which become very, very popular, really popular. But unfortunately, it's not any of her works translated into English. So I want to write a female adventurer. But by herself, but she has her husband. But why she has to meet her future husband on the road. And so I decided to write adventure stories. So at first I think I should write about Africa too, you know. I mean, not copy her, of course, but I just inspire her. But then later I really don't feel much. And I didn't have the chance to go to Africa then. I don't have the chance. So I said, okay, so I moved to the Silk Road. Because there has to be a desert in my novel, because all the adventures happen in the desert, because it's so dangerous. So I moved to the Silk Road. And the Silk Road, there are the Gobi Desert, you know, and the Taklamakan. And I choose the Taklamakan is only because its name is called Go In But Never Come Out, because it's wonderful for a novel, because it's so dangerous. So I wrote this story. And then the whole plot, I mean, it's not, of course, not really based on Sun Mao. I just inspired by her. Whole plot, actually, you just read, I got it from my dream, the whole plot. But don't think it's easy. It's not easy. I just have the plot. That means the plot might be half a page, but I still have to fill in the 400 pages novel. I mean, it's very hard work. But anyway, I'm happy, you know, it's out and it's doing very well. Let me see. Oh, all right. The aunt, it's not in the trailer, the aunt she never knew exists, the protagonist, her name is Lily. The aunt wrote her a letter saying that I was an adventurer, so now I want you to retrace my roots on the Silk Road, and you also go to meet all the people that I met on the Silk Road and do everything that I did on the Silk Road. If you can achieve all of this and if you can survive it in one piece, I'll give you, you have $3 million. Will you go? I will definitely the first one to go. Of course, go. And okay, what are the things she has to do? It's very strange things, but it's all resolved in the end. First, she has to go to see the terracotta soldiers. I didn't put on the slide. You know all this, the terracotta soldiers, you know, the rows and rows of armies. And to chip a small piece. Why? I mean, you have to read the novel to find out why. But this is what the aunt asked her to do, and the aunt she never knew in her life. And second, you have to seduce a monk, a Buddhist monk, up on the mountain. And not only you have to seduce him, I think all of you are over 21 here, so I can say. Not only you seduce the monk, you have to have sex with him in a certain position, which is called hanging upside down lotus. Go home, you can imagine, but you can't imagine here, it's too hard. Hanging upside down lotus. And a lot of people, my readers, think I made it up. No, I didn't make it up. I researched and I found it in ancient Chinese sex manual. I don't know whether you know about those manuals. Actually, a lot of those. They come with illustrations and they come with poems. So I translated the poems of this particular position. They have many, many, of course. Okay, so she has to seduce this monk. And she has to find this snow lotus, as I said. She also had to, what else? To find a blind fortune teller. But tell him nothing but lies. Why? Of course, they have to find out. Only lies. So she went through all this. she has to also go to the Purpan Museum where the mummies are and to steal two treasures. But those true treasures were actually stolen already. That means those in the museum were fake. She had to steal the fake. So she had to carry out all these, you know, demands by her aunt. And on her way, of course, she ran into the love of her life. That's a great love story there. Okay, and the love story is between an older woman and a younger man. And when I wrote it, because why I wrote an older woman and a younger man, it's not because it's trendy. It's just because, you know, the Taiwanese author, Sun Mao, because her husband was much younger than her. So that's why it inspired me to write a younger, you know, male protagonist. But then after I written in, a lot of people say, oh, it's very trendy, they have a love story, you know. Older woman and younger man, that's the cougar. You know the cougar? Yeah. And I told my husband, oh, my novel is about a cougar. My husband said, never use the word in front of me. It's extremely vulgar. You can't use that word. Okay. So I asked people what cougar is. And of course I know what it is. But and then I realized, actually, my protagonist, Lily, she's not a cougar. Why? Although she's older than a man. By 8 years, actually, not that much. The reason is, it's not because she went to seduce the man and chase around after him on the Silk Road. It's completely the other way around. The young man won't let go of her to chase her around along the Silk Road. But she wanted to get rid of him all the time. Why? She didn't want him to be in the way of her $3 million until she finished. So, but that's a great love story. Okay, I'm not going to tell you too much. I'm going to read first few pages, I guess. I haven't marked where I should read. Let me, because this is too long. So I read a little bit the beginning, so you have a taste. The first chapter is called The Million Dollar Journey. A Chinese saying goes, in good fortune is always some misfortune, and in misfortune, always some good fortune. Some Chinese might know where this comes from. It's a famous saying. Maybe they're right. After losing my parents at 28, I was abandoned, penniless, into this treacherous 10,000 miles of red dust, Xizhang, Hongcheng. Or so I had thought. Then a year later, I received a letter from a law firm in Manhattan, Muse and Mon, informing me that I was to be given a sum of money. In fact, a very large sum of money, $3 million. But from whom and why? Since I had to max out my credit card just to lay my parents in thin coffins and watch them with my hard-earned money turn into ashes. Wow. I had used all my willpower to stifle my about-to-be-shut-out, uncontrollable, deliriously happy laughter to be able to continue to read. My benefactress was someone by the name of Mindy Madison, supposedly my aunt from my mother's side. Neither of my parents had ever mentioned any aunt in this world, or the next one. So where could this Mindy Madison have come from? Let me skip this and okay. So she went to the law firm and the lawyers told her what her aunt required her to do, all these things that I just told you. And so it continues. Back home, I immediately plunged into reading Mindy Madison's documents. I flipped through the thick stack, reading a section here and skipping another one there. At first glance, I was quite relieved to find that the routes to take, cities to visit, people to meet, and things to do didn't seem all that daunting. However, as I read further, the request started to become a little weird, one even perverse. At the edge of a desert called the Taklamakan, I needed to retrieve something buried in a small, ruined town. I had to meet with a blind fortune teller on a certain mountain and tell him nothing but lies about everything, and the perverse one. I had to seduce a certain monk in a certain temple and have sex with him in a hanging upside-down lotus position, something I, though I considered myself pretty open about sex, had never heard of. Would I get a brain hemorrhage? I couldn't help but chuckle, not that I found this funny, but just hoping the chuckle would somehow dissipate the uneasy feelings that were emerging inside me. After I finished reading, I let out a sigh. The whole thing struck me as peculiar, very peculiar, and scary. If my aunt, Mindy Madison, had already done these things, then why pay me to repeat them? There must be something not quite proper or downright crooked going on behind all this. But what? I had no idea. Like a bad cold, the uneasy feeling refused to go away. I don't know if I should read more or not. I don't want. Let me see. Or maybe you have any questions? Any questions?
What was the hardest part of working on this novel? The writing or the research? What do you think?
research is relatively easy because there's so many information available nowadays, you know, books, online, websites, all kinds of things. It just takes time, but it's not hard. Trust me, it's not hard, the research. Actually, it's you fill in all the pages, and my intention is every page and every single sentence has to be interesting. If I find one sentence, oh, I go to school tomorrow and take a bus, I'll cross it out right away. It's boring. Who wants to read that sentence? So if I have, let's say, 500,000 sentences in my novel, every single one I have to polish it till it's interesting. Either it's some imagery there or, metaphor or whatever. It has to be interesting. If it's not, I would rather cut out 100. I mean, like my second novel, The Petals of the Sky, I cut out 100 pages. And the green one, I cut out 45 pages before I reached the really essence, you know, compact form. So this is the hard part. Is you, every sentence you have to, just like you play the piano, the same. Every note you have to pay the same attention, every nuance of each note. And the nuance of your fingering, configuration of fingering, everything. That's the hardest part. And every sentence structure, you cannot be boring. Every sentence structure has to be different from the one, around them. And also, of course, you think of the plot, because my plot is fairly convoluted. A lot of twists and also a lot of happening. I don't have that. If you heard about the writers always like to say the sagging middle about writing, that means in the middle part you don't know what to write anymore, except you know the beginning and conclusion. But that doesn't happen to me at all. And I just, beginning to end, has to be grab your attention. There's no sagging. And that is hard. You have to put in enough things, you know, to fill 360 pages. And I think one of my teachers in the past told me that 360 pages or 400, doesn't matter. If you just copy someone else's work, and you type, just type, copy, you don't have to think. You don't have to think of a novel. You still have very hard work, let alone you have to write it out yourself. Yeah. And I edit every novel about 10 times before I send it in. So it's a lot of work. Yeah.
Ming, you said that you got the plot from this novel from In a Dream. Do most of your did you dream the other plots of your other two books? Did they come that
way? Not that easy. I wish it's that easy. This one, the red one, Peach Blossom Pavilion, is about the last Chinese geisha. Because most people know about Japanese geisha. No one heard of, in the United States, no one heard of, actually, almost, Chinese geisha, but they exist in China 2,500 years ago, during the Warring States period. And they are well-versed, cultivated in the four Chinese literary arts, which is music, calligraphy, chess, and painting, or poetry, you know, the four. And since I was trained in the four arts too when I was a teenager, so I think I'm kind of, I can write this book because I know about those. And it's about geisha, but in Chinese, in the Song Dynasty, actually it had the same name as the Japanese geisha, but later they were called the Mingji, the famous prostitutes. That's what they were called. But they are not like prostitute. Not like what we think nowadays. It's actually courtesans, you know, very cultivated ones. So when I sent in this book for editors, a lot asked me, is it about yourself? Is it a compliment or an insult? I don't know. But anyway, I'm glad in a way because it's so real. So this one, I didn't get it from a dream, but this one is from my research, and also because the courtesan in the novel, she played the instrument that I play, the chin. So I already know a lot. And however, when I researched those, because I am a scholar on my instrument, so I researched on women, particularly women who play this instrument, because mostly it's dominated by male in the past, in history. So I researched on the women player, and I found out that there are different women players, nuns, gentry women, that means society ladies, rich people's wives, concubines, whatever, palace ladies play it, and also courtesan. So it's a big discovery for me that courtesan play this instrument. So I have to write an novel to give them a voice, because they didn't have a voice for so long. No voice. And they're extremely talented. When I did my research, I read their poems handed down from 1,000 years old. Like Yu Shenji is from the Tang Dynasty. It's 1,000 year old. And she still has 109 poems left now in the complete Tang Dynasty poems. I read all her poems. I read many of these prestigious prostitutes' poems, their paintings, a lot of stories about them, and a lot which really touched me is because they had a very bad situation in life, very bad life. Why? I mean, some actually came from rich families, but why they end up being prostitutes? Because the family lost the riches overnight. That happened. They just lost everything overnight. And sometimes the parents died young, and the stepmother, actually we call it the second wife or concubine, they sold the little girl to be a prostitute. That's why some little girl already very cultivated, even before they were trained in the prostitution house. But these women, they didn't have a voice in fiction, so I decided to give them a voice. So I researched a lot, you know, about their lives. And the yellow one, The Palace from the Sky, is about a would-be Buddhist nun. She tried to be a Buddhist nun, but then test her karma to be Buddhist nun, so she went to a Buddhist temple for a Buddhist retreat, but a fire broke out in the temple, and she was saved by a handsome stranger, an American, and he scooped her up and took her out of the fire. And that was the first time she had physical contact with a man in her 30 years of life, because she wanted to be a nun. And she didn't know what that is, but she felt stirred. Because you know what that is, because she never had a man in her life. But then in this situation, she completely thrust on a different path. That is the second one. Any more questions? I don't want to myself keep talking.
Are the characters in your book of women?
So far, the protagonists, I want to write about strong Chinese woman characters for now. In the future, I might change, but I have so many stories to tell. Because I have an interesting life. I grew up with Buddhist nuns myself, and I met a lot of interesting people in my life. For now, I don't think I have... the resource is endless to tell all these stories. I just don't have enough time to tell them, because writing a book, the fastest is I doing now is once a year. That's the fastest. You can't be faster than that. And so, yes. And my next one is called The Skeleton Woman. It's about, as I said, femme fatale in French. That means... And a lot of my friends, they read it and say, oh, is it anorexic? No. So it's not that interesting, right, anorexic woman. I said, no. It's because in Chinese, actually, there's a Chinese phrase, but the younger Chinese, I don't think you heard about it now. It's called Hong Fen Ku Lu, the pink skeleton. That means femme fatale. Why? Because they can turn you into the skeleton. So this novel is about a woman spy. But she didn't spy for countries like China spy for Japan. No, she didn't spy for country. She spy for gangsters. She belonged to one gangster head, the second most powerful, and she spy for the most powerful one. So it's a lot of adventures and a lot of interesting things happen in this one. And so this is the next one coming out. And then the one after this is about an embroiderer. I work it out, I have life. So I don't know when I will change to write about something else. So far, I still not...
Something about yourself?
That one is... the yellow one is... I add a lot of stuff, but it's basically my storyline, the yellow one, yeah. Because I grew up with Buddhist nuns. And those nuns, there are two different kinds of nuns in the world. One is called the mountain meditating, monks and nuns. You go to the mountain and you meditate. And the other one is the entering the world, monks and nuns. And in the yellow novel, I wrote about both kinds. The one that I know very well, actually, she was not really my mentor, but we just know each other very, very well since teenager. She is the entering the world nun. And she's now a billionaire businessman. I mean, it sounds commercial, but that's the way the world is. Don't be fooled, you know. Don't be fooled by, you know, oh. But they look at this Shaolin, you know. It's an enterprise now. It is an enterprise, yeah. But, however, I'm not criticizing them. It's good being an enterprise because actually they make a lot of money from donation, and then they really, they build hospitals, orphanage, no more orphanage in Hong Kong because it's Hong Kong is not poor anymore, so you cannot find. But when I knew her temple, she still had an orphanage. The hospital, orphanage, art gallery, museum, all kinds of things. Yeah, I mean, they're doing good stuff.
Who are you talking about?
No, I can't tell you. No, I can't tell you. Yeah. Any more questions?
Are you going to do another children's book?
I also write and illustrate children's books. Yeah, you can take the bookmark, please, later. I'm doing a second one now. Yeah, so keep me busy. Yeah,
you want to... Oh, yeah, can you show us the calligraphy?
Yeah, of course. All right, and let me see. Then I can take this off, I guess. Okay, I'm going to demonstrate calligraphy. I didn't expect to do a big piece of calligraphy. That's why I only bring small paper. Because that one I'm going to demonstrate has a story, and this is not a big piece. Anyone can, Anthony, I don't want to have a newspaper. Are you sure? Okay. And and also because I'm doing small calligraphy, I didn't bring a big brush, so I don't know whether I can do with this small brush. I don't know whether I can do it. Because the one that I meant to demonstrate is small. Yeah, I don't know. Okay. All of you know the word karma, right? Buddhism talks a lot of karma. That's the seed we plant in the world, you know, in our life. And that's what you get, if not in this life, in your next life, because we believe in reincarnation. So don't do bad deeds. You have to be compassionate, and also you have to have wisdom. Okay, so I'm going to write a word karma and a Zen poem together with this word. But excuse me, because I don't have the, you know, the thick pen. I don't know. This might not, no. Okay, you just have some idea. But this is not the right brush at all, because I didn't bring the... And I'll explain to you later. Not the right brush, but it just have you have some ideas, because the brush strokes should be much thicker than this, because I don't have a... Okay, this is the word karma, and the Zen poem says, you follow the fragrant flowers there, and then you again follow, you chase the fallen petals back here. Can you guess what it means? It looks like a simple poem, right? You chase the fragrance grass there, and then you follow the fallen petals back here. This is actually a most important Chinese concept, and including Taoism, Buddhism, whatever, is the cyclic, the cycle, continuity of life. You know, it just always like this. Chinese is always about circles. You know, the Tai Chi symbol is circle. You know, everything is, we never end. You know, it's just always continuous. So actually, that's what it means. The Zen poem. Okay, I'm going to do this one. I don't need the newspaper because it looks ugly. Okay. This I copy here. I want to enlarge it so you have a clearer look. But my... Yeah, I think so. Let me finish this. Okay. How to explain? On the Silk Road, there are many treasures, right? This is one of those. It's written by a soldier sent from China to Tibet, young soldier. And of course, I mean, like any soldiers, you know, young or old, you send out to fight, it's very, very scary. So he wrote this like a sutra. You know, you don't know what sutra is, like a scripture, you know, religious text, and somewhat based, you know, on ancient text. So he wrote it so to protect himself. And this was one of the treasures found, you know, on the Silk Road. It's about 1,000 years old. So I'm going to copy his work, write his work. And then, I meant to enlarge this so you'd have a clearer look, but my machine just didn't work today. And then the red thing is another talisman. You know what talisman, right? Like amulet, but in text. The Taoist talisman, written by someone also for protection. So I'm combining the two. And if you like, you can... do we have enough space? You can come here. I don't know whether exactly done, but it's...
This is a simplified language. It's not the traditional Chinese writing.
You mean this or this?
No, I mean this one. This thing like...
I have to check. Not necessarily. Sometimes when you look at the Zhao dictionary, actually they use this
Xu Dong became the chairman, and he's trying to simplify the Chinese writing.
Right, but most of them actually has already existed even before he simplified. Yeah, many of them actually.
You're right.
Scholars in the old days always write simplified. They don't write the whole thing.
I think it's too hard because even with the glasses, I can't really see it. Okay. Let me one more, okay? Not yet. To do the food. I don't have the red brush, it's too hot. So it doesn't exist.
It's okay, it
feels
very nice.
Thank you. For your protection. Okay, any questions? Look at my books.